indeed. Welcome to News Talk Breakfast on this, the second day of summer. And if you're just waking up, we have, for a rare opportunity to say to you this morning, we've got good news for you this morning. It's going to be a sizzler today, and it's going to be a sizzler for the rest of the week. So this is one of those rare mornings we can all feel chirpy and happy. As I said, temperatures are set to be hotter here than in Ibiza, and the mercury is expected to hit 19 degrees with dry and sunny conditions today, and similar weather is forecast for the rest of the week. Maybe the odd little shower. And next weekend, it's also going to be good as well.
Yeah,
good morning.
Good morning, Paul. I had the t-shirt and shorts on yesterday. You had kind of a version of it, I'd say. Kind of maybe a lycra version on, maybe, was it?
Yeah, here he goes.
We should warn everyone. Throughout the show today, there might be some kind of weird grunts and groans in the background. Yeah. The odd little yelp. Do you want to explain why, Paul?
Yeah, because I broke my arm.
You broke it. How did you break your arm, Paul?
I fell, Kieran.
How did you fall?
I fell off an object, Kieran, onto a roadway.
Did you take the stabilisers off that object very recently? Was that the problem?
I was on my bike, my giant racer bike. Yes, okay, I know it's karma. And I know you're just bursting to say it to me. It's karma. The guy who's been slagging off cyclists is himself a closet cyclist who fell off and nearly killed himself the weekend. Figures released by the HSE have shown the parents of sick children attending Our Lady's Children's Hospital in Crumlin contributed almost €500,000 in car parking fees last year alone. Now, the cost of parking is just one of a number of hidden fees which parents must contend with when caring for their sick children in hospitals across the country. Now, joining us on the line to discuss this is the co-founder of the charity Cleanus Foundation and his Cleanus dad, Brendan Ring. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Paul.
What's your opinion on these figures? Are you shocked? €500,000, €460,000.
Look, I'm not shocked because I'm very familiar with the costs that are associated with families that have to travel to hospitals on an ongoing basis. And that's just the numbers from Crumlin. It's almost €500,000. But there are a number of other hospitals throughout the country that there are kids attending, as we speak this morning. And there are parents that have to cough up just for the parking. And it's an awful lot of money. But like, there are so many other hidden costs as well, is that these families are not just able to deal with this. I mean, look, we were in that situation with our own daughter, Cleena. We spent 8 years going to a number of hospitals. We're based here in Limerick. Regularly on a Monday morning, we'd have to be up at 5:30. We'd have to drive to Crumlin with Cleena. She was very, very ill. We had to go through a day of chemotherapy with her and come back down here at home. And if you think about that, it's unbelievably stressful. It tests you to your very end. And then when you arrive, you've got to put your hands in your pocket to pay for car parking. You've got to pay for the fuel for your car. That's if you have a car. We were fortunate that we had a car. People would have to go public transport. To go to Dublin from Limerick on a train is €60. That's just for one person. It goes on and on and on. Like, it costs approximately €200 for a child to be treated in this country every day for the non-medical expenses, of which parking is a big cost.
By the way, what are they're some of the hidden costs? Have you any examples of any other hidden costs that are associated with caring for a sick child?
The problem, Paul, is firing, because, I mean, if you're paying money for parking, you're paying money for accommodation, you're paying money for extra food, you're paying money maybe to have your children looked after, right, then the bills at home have not been taken care of. So we're ending up having to pay mortgages, paying for oil, helping parents like my own wife who had to stop working because Cleena was so unwell. We have to supplement families' incomes. It goes on and on and on. So the hidden costs people don't realise are out there, and we are only one charity in Ireland that's able to help these families, and we receive no state support. And again this morning, when I read it at the weekend about the car parking costs, it's not on, because these guys do not realise that we are the parents with children that are either terminally ill or they've got a life-limiting illness. We just can't take the pressure. And there are families here who are on the breadline. And I quote one family recently that told me, look, Brendan, I either put food in our presses this morning or I go and spend some time with my child in a hospital. That's what's going on.
Now,
it's crazy.
Now, Brendan, you lost your little girl. So you were going through the most extraordinary and unimaginable emotional pain and worry and angst and you're still worrying, you have to worry about this. Stories come to mind about how parents with very sick children and very sick relatives in hospitals have found themselves around the country being clamped when they come out of the hospital because obviously they can't think straight when they're going into it. The last thing you're going to do is think about paying for your parking in advance or putting a ticket on the car as well.
It's funny you mentioned that because I'm one of those parents that I went to a hospital in Ireland and I was totally distraught. We got very bad news about Kena. She had a brain tumour which was inoperable. And Kena got very unwell, and unfortunately, she passed away. And it was during that time I actually double parked on a footpath in a hospital grounds. And when I got out the next day, basically, we had to spend all that day and night with Kena. I was clamped. It's unbelievable.
And when you came out of the hospital, did you speak to anybody and say to them, "By the way, listen, my child is terminally ill here. Yeah. I've told the things in my mind."
Yes, I did, and that didn't make any difference. I still had to pay, I think at the time, was a 60 or 80 euros. The only break that we ever got was, I remember being speeding the night coming up from Limerick here in town. Kena had to have emergency blood platelets replaced, and I was caught speeding. And we've only got two children, Kena, our daughter, and we have a son, and he was with me in the front because my wife, Terry, had to stay with Kena that night in the hospital. And the average number of nights, bed nights, the children spend in this country is about 50. So that's 50 nights at a cost of 200 euros, of which the car parking could be, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 euros.
But right? You say you were caught for speeding. That was obviously by the guards, was it?
It was. And I said to God, I'm sorry about that. Yeah. But I said, my daughter has a brain tumour. She's very unwell. And he just said, you have enough in your...
And he used his discretion and showed some compassion. The guards are the only people in situations like this that I know of who actually do show compassion.
He did. He was wonderful. He said, "You have enough problems on your plate, son." He said, "Drive on."
You can take a look at that from a company point of view and say, "Well, you know, we're building a network. We're investing money. Mm-hmm. We can't keep going from 4G to 5G to 6G, et cetera, unless we've cash." So that's the rationale. Yes. However, you're not happy.
I'm not happy because they're changing the goalposts on us, the consumer. I don't know about you, but I pay a lot of money for my phone bill. I buy a new phone. I do all the different things that we're meant to do. And now, because of something that's bigger than the consumer, you know, we didn't make up these rules. It's something that the EU, it's an EU initiative. And yet, mobile networks are changing the goalposts, changing the terms and conditions so that we, the consumer, are paying more. So a few weeks ago, we talked about the changes that are going to happen on three bills. Pay, but they're also now on the 15th of May changing the terms and conditions of their pay-as-you-go offering. So if you are pay-as-you-go on Three and you top up by 20 euro each month, you'll now have to top up every 28 days rather than every 30 days.
Okay, that's two out of 28 of six. So you're topping 6-7%. They're gaining on this.
Yeah, so basically what if you top up, say, once a month, you're going to now have to top up 13 times in a year rather than just 12 times in a year. It may not sound massive, but what they've done, as well as changing how many days your credit lasts for, they've also changed the T's and C's and the fine print. So there's a thing within the EU that says you should be able to roam like home. Yep. That means use your calls, data and texts as you would. But what Three have done, and Meteor have also followed suit, so if you're a Meteor customer, you're not scot-free, they have changed how much data is actually allocated to you to use like you're roaming at home. So let me explain how this works. First up, if you top up by 20 quid on Three, you get unlimited 3-to-3 texts, any network texts within the Republic of Ireland and the EU, and unlimited 3-to-3 calls. They've changed the wording. So it says you get free 4G, which means that if you're using your phone at home on 4G, you get that for absolutely free. If you're using data within the Republic of Ireland or the EU, you only have 2 gigabytes. So it's a play on words, basically. They're trying to just change the wording so that you only have 2 gigs to use whilst roaming. That's the roam like home.
But in other words, you're only getting 2 gigs at home as well.
No, because you're using the 4G. So you still have all you can eat at home, but once you're out and about and you're in the EU, it's just, I don't know why they have it.
I mean, are you sure about that? Because it says data, Republic of Ireland and EU, 2 gigabytes.
Yeah.
Then it says 4G free. But I mean, you use the 4G network, for example, to make a phone call if it's available
if it's on
to
WhatsApp.
You.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. But it's just their wording so that they're saying that you have 2 gigs of data allowance on your phone bill. That is what's used when you're roaming around the EU. But when you're at home, you've got all you can eat. It's it's the all you can eat 4G basically.
Now, did you clarify the notion which we discussed before about if you're on bill pay and they change the bill unilaterally, and now on the bill pay they change the rules unilaterally, that you can just say, ah, to hell with 3, I'll go with somebody else and I'll keep the phone?
Yep, that's completely true. So if you're a bill pay customer and you've received notification from the network that your bill is going up by €5, you have 30 days from the day you receive that text or letter to get out of jail free, basically. That means that you don't have to pay a penalty to leave the network. It also means that even if you signed up to 3 2 weeks ago and got a €700 phone as part of your bill, you get to walk away from that with your phone intact and you can move to another network. You can also decide to stick with 3 and go on a pay-as-you-go offer or shop around and go around. We actually have a very comprehensive guide to what to look for when you're moving network up on newstalk.com/technology if you want to take a look.
Now, scientists have carried out a successful head transplant on rats, ahead of plans to attempt a similar operation on a human later this year. The procedure was carried out by a team which included Sergio Canavero, a controversial Italian neurosurgeon. For more on this, I'm joined by Tom Whipple, science editor with The Times UK. Tom, good morning.
Morning, hello.
And now, can you explain to us exactly what this two-headed rat operation involved?
It's a bit disgusting, I think, would be a moderate way of describing it. There were 3 rats involved in the procedure. In increasing order of unluckiness, we start with the one that acted as a blood donor. There was one of the rats which was there to provide a supply of blood to another rat who had its head cut off. That head was kept alive by this donor rat and then transplanted onto the back of a third rat, where it appeared to stay alive for 36 hours.
So they just made sure that the blood supply from the surviving rat, who ended up with 2 heads, the blood supply was linked up to the rat's head, the donor rat's head. So it circulated through the brain and so on, and
yes,
the second head stayed alive.
The second head stayed alive. Now, it stayed alive on the back of a third rat. I mean, this is the neuroscientist behind this says that by the end of the year, he'll be able to do a head transplant on humans. And he's not talking about creating a two-headed human. He's talking about moving the head of one human onto the body of another. So it's this experiment in rats, which was successful for 36 hours, is a very, very long way from what he plans to do in humans.
The blood supply is one thing. You've got arteries bringing the blood and veins taking them away and all the rest of it. That, it's not straightforward, but it's relatively speaking straightforward. But I'm thinking of the spinal cord. I'm thinking of nerve endings. I'm thinking of all the complexities that go into, be it a rat or a human head. I mean, how many of those elements did they manage to connect up?
In this case, they weren't trying to do that. They claim in a dog, they've severed 90% of its spinal column and then reattached it. Almost when you get into these details, it becomes, at least to conventional neuroscientists, quite absurd, because you will struggle to find people other than those working with him who'll say this is remotely a possibility. We're not even really at the stage where you can reattach someone's own spinal cord to their own spinal cord. Let alone take a head from someone and put it on someone else's spinal cord. So that's the very difficult thing.
Well, nobody, I think, is arguing against them putting it there, because I think co-location is key in the provision of modern and good reproductive health care for the women of Ireland. So we want it next to an adult hospital, and St Vincent's is a good hospital, and that all works for everybody. Where the problem arises is around 2 things. One is around ownership. The state is going to spend €300 million building this hospital and no longer own it. It's going to gift it to the Sisters of Charity. That's the first thing. And the second thing is around control. The Sisters of Charity will exclusively own the company that runs the hospital, and they have the majority control on the board that runs the hospital. So 4 2/3 members of the board that will be running the National Maternity Hospital will be nominated by the Sisters of Charity. And I think the key thing here is this, is Why do they want that? It is indicative of a problem when the St. Vincent's Hospital Group are attempting to control the National Maternity Hospital, because there's no reason why they should want to control the National Maternity Hospital. The National Maternity Hospital does a very fine job of controlling itself.
Well, Ola, while you said just a couple of minutes ago, you said St. Vincent's is a very fine hospital. And that's the sister's charity, isn't it?
It is. But
so if it's a very fine hospital, why would the National Maternity Hospital not be a very fine hospital as well?
Because, George, there is a fundamental conflict in areas of female reproductive health care with the Catholic Church. And I'm not just talking about abortion. They don't approve of contraception. They don't approve of assisted reproduction like IVF. They don't approve of sterilisation. They don't approve of the morning after pill. They don't approve of egg freezing. There's loads of things that modern female reproductive health care does that the Catholic Church is at odds with, which wouldn't be the case with cardiac care or cancer care or those types of things.
But you're part of a group, doctors, who kind of believe you know best. Now,
only when it comes to healthcare, George,
well,
but then absolutely, yeah, they do know best.
That's strictly true. The other thing that grabbed my attention while I was on holiday was that the Egyptians had some 76-year-old woman have a baby. So obviously a bunch of doctors believed ethically that was a good idea. Then after 3 months, social welfare came along and took the baby away because they knew a 76-year-old woman couldn't look after it.
That's sort of a tangential point now.
No, but it is and it isn't, in the sense that when Mary Harney's brilliant idea to fix the HSE was to put a doctor in charge. I can't even remember what his name is. Such was his lack of impact on it. So doctors don't necessarily have the entire answer to this. Now, I don't have the answer.
Do you want the answer?
Well, except I do know this. When we went into hospitals run by the nuns, and there actually were nuns there running the place, we didn't get MRSA or all these kind of things, and it worked. And then when the doctors got in charge and the non-nuns got in charge, the hospital system went to pot, no?
Well, the nuns are still in charge of St. Vincent's Hospital, so I'm not sure that applies. But also, you do bear in mind one thing. The lack of antibiotic-resistant bugs wasn't purely down to the nuns. It was because we didn't have antibiotics. So antibiotics, over the time that they've been used, we've developed resistance to them.
Non-tangential or whatever you say. Let's come back to the issue at hand.
Let
this point. There are 213 nuns in the country.
Yeah.
Average age is 76.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there are any novices or not.
I don't think there are.
Right. So 10 years from now, the hospital probably will only be opening there won't be any nuns anywhere.
But the Sisters of Charity, the trust that is in perpetuity set up by the Sisters of Charity, which will be a religious corporation, if you like, will run the hospital. And that's, to be honest, more worrying than the nuns themselves, because the nuns themselves are individually very nice women, many of whom have worked in places like Africa, many of whom have a lot of sympathy and empathy for women in crisis pregnancies and all sorts of things. A religious-run corporation, which is basically a religious Catholic ethos property portfolio, has a slightly different perspective on things, I would suggest. And that's even more concerning.
Now, Skippy Jessop is a 39-year-old Mormon from Utah. And because he's unmarried and a Mormon, he's a virgin. In fact, a few years back, he featured on a TV show called The Virgin Diaries. But Skippy has another interesting claim to fame. Sort of. For years, he's been keeping his belly button fluff. Skippy, good afternoon.
Morning for me, yeah.
Indeed.
How are you guys?
We're great, thanks very much. And thanks very much, Skippy, for talking to us today.
Genuinely excited. You guys are, a couple of years ago, I got to do some interviews when I was on the show for Virgin Diaries, and I never got to talk to Ireland, I don't believe. So this is exciting for me.
All right. So this is, so you're kind of an Ireland interview virgin as well as an actual virgin.
Yeah, exactly. You're de-virginizing me there in Ireland. This is wonderful.
How much belly button lint do you think you have at this stage?
You know, I haven't weighed it, so I can say it hasn't grown too much since the show from 4 years ago. So if you remember what it was on Virgin Diaries, it was about, so I would say a jar and a half, and I've been collecting it since I was around 20 years old.
Mm. And what prompted you to start collecting it?
Okay, so I was on my Mormon mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons, and I was serving in Michigan. And I wasn't the best missionary, but as missionaries, there's a few things that you're supposed to do every single day. And I mean, aside from like showering kind of thing, you know, there's a strong encouragement for missionaries to write in their journals, to read from the scriptures every day. And, you know, sometimes I was a lazy missionary, and I was thinking one day, like, literally, you know, just kind of a self-evaluation thing, what do I do every single day? I shower, but then I was thinking, like, oh, and with that, for me, comes checking my belly button lint. And I was like, I wonder how much I would collect if I just like saved it up for my mission. And I found this little jar, and I put it in. And so, like, until the show aired, literally maybe 15 people on the planet knew that I had it, you know.
Yeah.
So for like the final year of my mission, there was about like 7 other missionaries that you serve with, and I'm not even sure if those 7 knew. And then like 1 or 2 of my friends, but seriously, I could count on 2 hands the number of people that prior to the show knew that I even had it.
Yeah, and so you started collecting it, and this is 20 years ago, but
yeah,
you kept collecting it. Why do you think you kept collecting it?
I continued as a part of the getting ready to shower kind of thing, like checking it.
Mm.
And since I had a place to collect it, I didn't see any need to stop collecting it.
Kind of thing.
Even though, don't get me wrong, I get how odd it is. And it's also why I didn't just like approach girls and be like, hi, I'm Skippy. I'm 34 years old at the time, now 39. I live in mom's basement. And would you like to see my belly button lint collection? No, it's one of those things where it's an odd thing, but I don't know. I think that there's way worse things that people can collect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
In January, European Athletics set up a task force to look into the credibility of world records, and its ruling council has now ratified the proposals put forward by the task force, and it wants the IAAF to adopt the changes it sets out. So if the proposals are adopted by the IAAF, which seems very, very possible indeed, a world record would only be recognised if it meets all 3 of the following criteria. So number 1, it was achieved at a competition on a list of approved international events where the highest standards of officiating and technical equipment can be guaranteed. Number 2, the athlete had been subject to an agreed number of doping control tests in the months leading up to it. And then crucially, number 3, the doping control sample taken after the record has been stored and available for retesting for 10 years. And that one is especially key because the IAAF has only stored blood and urine samples since 2005. So in effect, if you're pre-2005, you're stricken from the record. We have Dr. Ross Tucker, regular on the show and professor of exercise physiology on the line. Evening, Ross.
How's it going, Jack?
Very well. So can we talk about world records in broad strokes? And obviously, there's going to be collateral damage in this potential IAAF decision. And there will also be some collateral damage in our conversation. But for the sake of painting some broad strokes, we might just do that.
I think actually that's important, because certainly the discussion I've seen today has been massively sidetracked by individual reaction to specific cases. And you can't deal with this issue if you get stuck on one line in the record books.
Yeah. Well, I was reading, you wrote about this back in around the Olympics, and we'll tweet out a link to the piece, just about world records generally. Like, there's fascinating stuff in it. And so we could chart maybe some of these world records and when they were set and the sport's wider relationship with doping at that time. And, you know, you talked in this piece about how steroids were the prominent drug of choice in the 1970s and 1980s particularly, and then 1990s, early 2000s, EPO and blood doping comes into popularity very much so. So if we just look at, say, 70s and 80s in particular, there are some glaring pockets. We might just start with women's sprint records, which is what we're talking about here. The 100, 200, 400, short hurdles, 800 metres women's records, which stand today, they all date back to the 1980s and this steroid era.
Yeah, the one exception being the women's 100 metre hurdles, the short hurdles, because that was broken last year after I think I'd written that piece.
Yeah.
So you're right. And so what's happened there is that steroids were used widely in, as you said, the 1970s and 80s. We think that steroids have a bigger effect on women than men because they're anabolic, which basically means they increase muscle mass and so forth, and women have a bigger gain to make in theory from that. And so what happened is that prior to sophisticated testing, the use of steroids pushed those world records out so far that 30 years of technology and advanced training and knowledge and sophistication hasn't even made a dent in them. So you look, as you said, you go down there from 100 to 200 to 400 to 800. No one's come close to those records in the last 30 years. So they are fossils as a consequence of steroid use that at the time could not be tested.
Mm. So that's just, I mean, and so in 30 years' time, if we're still sitting here and those records are not stricken, is there every possibility that they would still stand?
I think so, yeah. I think if you look at that 400-meter world record, for example, and just, I know we said we weren't going to get stuck on them.
Sure.
But these records are between 1% and 2% faster than anything that anyone has ever done since. And at the elite level, that's enormous. So no one's even threatened to come near those records. So I reckon they would stand. And that's why this discussion about resetting the records comes up every single time people look at the lists, because they see these things as monuments to an era where doping was basically rampant. And some would say it is now, but it certainly has changed in nature. Mm. You know, I've seen in that article, there's a graph showing the average of the top 20 discus performances and also the best performance year on year. And they just go up and up and up and up. And then in 1987, they start introducing out of competition drug tests for steroids. And all of a sudden, instantly, the discus performance drops down again. So anti-doping did have an effect, but prior to that, there was no speed limit, and so things were just getting out of hand.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, in the field events, no world records this century in shot put, discus, long jump, triple jump, high jump.
Yeah, pretty much, and that's the case. I'm just looking at it right now to make sure I don't mislead you, but you're right. Not a single one, except for women's pole vault, and that's because that's a new event. So it was only introduced this century, really.
Yeah, and so the steroid era, it's less of a bridge for male athletes to try and gap, because, as you've sort of alluded to, the effect of testosterone is larger for women than men. So theoretically, with women, you're adding something to nothing, whereas for men, there's some there already. So it's less of a gap. That steroid era is not as impossible for the current generation of male sprinters.
Yeah, that's the theory, certainly. And there were some papers that were smuggled out of the East German system in the 1980s, and they were trying as much as possible to track the benefits that athletes would get. And the evidence from those documents suggests that that was the case. They were saying, for instance, that steroids would help a woman in the 800 by 5 to 6 seconds, whereas men would get 2 to 3 seconds. So, yeah, a relatively larger effect for women.
So if we take it that up until, say, around 04 or so, EPO is effectively undetectable in endurance sport, where are we over larger distances across the 90s and early 2000s?
Yeah, so then you shift away, because as I said, this out of competition testing begins in the 1987. It's not yet sophisticated enough to detect all the steroids, because you would know, those who follow the sport, you had Ben Johnson in 1988, dinoxazole. So the athletes kept using it, and some of them were caught, some of them were not. But in the 1990s, I think you saw a shift towards EPO type doping, blood doping. And the consequence was that the endurance records were then broken in a spate in the 1990s. And the most famous of those was that the Chinese, who, in the women, it was probably a combination of EPO and also steroids, but they broke every world record from 1,500 meters up over a period of a few years in 1993. Mm. There were a host of men's world records in the late 1990s. And again, here, if you look at another sport, cycling, it's instructive, because that was the period over which cycling performances were getting faster and faster. We now know why that was. It was because EPO was being used in the professional sport in the peloton. And why would the same not have been true in track and field? So.